You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I'm Karen Shook, books editor, and my guest today is Hester Vasey, college lecturer in modern German history at the University of Cambridge and admissions tutor for the arts at Clare College. Almost as importantly, and the reason for Hester being our guest today, is that she is author of Born in the GDR, Living in the Shadow of the Wall. Her new book focuses primarily on a group of eight people, all of whom were born after the wall went up in 1961, and thus who had known no life other than that under communism. So when in November 1989 we saw the destruction of the wall and following it the swift end of the 40-year state, their lives changed irrevocably. One of the people you quote in this book, Hester, says, "I didn't move a meter, but I suddenly lived in a new world."
Yeah, I think the disruption was profound for every East German who lived through the experience as their country was effectively swallowed up afterwards in the reunification process. Another person in the book says they had always wanted to travel, which wasn't something that was they were free to do in the German Democratic Republic in East Germany, but they always wanted to be able to come back home. And their home was gradually sort of eroded and changed and became ever sort of less familiar. And so that was just that's just one insight into how their world changed once the wall fell.
That was a very poignant observation. So many people in the book were able to travel, but only within the Eastern Bloc. So Hungary was as good as it got. And some of them, in fact, one of the people you interviewed, Mario, when he was in Hohenschönhausen prison, looked up and saw a Pan Am plane and thought about the fact that it was going somewhere that he wasn't able to. And yet the person you quote says, "I could travel, but I expected to come home, and there was no home."
So, when Mario was locked up by the Stasi, yes, when he was allowed outside just a couple of times a week for half an hour at a time, he looked up at the sky, and when he saw, which he wasn't allowed to do, but when the guards weren't looking, not pointing their guns at him, he looked up at the sky. And when he saw a Pan Am plane, he sort of said to himself, "One day I'm going to be on one of those planes." And obviously now he says that the experience of travelling is all the sweeter for knowing that he wasn't able to do it before. But it's a bit of a misconception that no one could travel in the GDR, because the wall came up in 1961, but East Germans were able to travel if they got the permission from the East German government. Whether they got that permission was entirely at the whim of the authorities, but old people, pensioners, for example, were able to travel to the West. The whole rationale behind the wall was to try and stop the kind of flooding out of East Germans into West Germany after 1949, between 1949 and 1961, the equivalent of a town's worth of people moved between, you know, communist East Germany to capitalist West Germany. So the idea was that the wall would keep the numbers up in East Germany in this sort of competitive Cold War climate. But as I said, these pensioners, even after the wall came up, were able to travel because they were no longer working for the state. So if they did decide to leave, their economic contribution, they weren't making an economic contribution to the state anymore, so their loss wouldn't be felt so enormously. And there was also a sense that maybe East Germans who were of a certain age wouldn't want to uproot their lives, so it was most likely that they would come back. And one man that I spoke to in the book said that, you know, when he was asked when he was little what he wanted to be when he grew up, he said he wanted to be his grandmother, because she was the only person in his family who could travel to the West, and then she'd bring back sweets and all sorts of goodies that weren't available in the East. But businessmen were able to travel, and actually from with the permission of the government, and from 1982 actually, if East Germans had relatives in West Germany who had either died or were getting married or had a big birthday, they were able to travel sometimes if the state allowed it. So I think before I started my research and knew anything about as I thought that you know, the wall was up and no one could move between each between certainly east to west, but that wasn't the case. But I guess the crucial point with the fall of the wall in November 1989 was from that moment people could travel freely without needing the permission of the government.
The difference between this book and your first book, Surviving Hitler's War, is, it would seem to me, the sources you used. Surviving Hitler's War drew on letters and diaries to talk about the experience of women in Germany from 1939 until after the war. In this case, you're talking to people who are very much alive, as well as drawing on printed materials. Is it a whole different kettle of fish for a historian when you, and you discuss this to a certain extent in the book, when you've got the person sitting there in front of you instead of the diary or the archive papers?
It is. It is a totally different kettle of fish. It's, on the one hand, a lot more immediate, and it's very compelling when you sit there and someone tells you the story, and you're, unlike with sources such as letters where the people are no longer alive, you can obviously ask them questions. It's a lot more of an interactive process. But historians can be quite sceptical about the benefits of oral history, you know, interview testimony and what you can learn from them, because I suppose there's a danger that as an interviewer you might ask leading questions, or the way people present their story. I mean, that's the same in a diary or in a letter. There's, you know, you have to consider who the audience is and you know, what the person's trying to project. So I mean, as historians there are always problems with the sources, but I think it's rather good that you can continue to ask questions. I found these people by, I interviewed about 30 people, and found them by pushing adverts through people's doors, putting posters up in supermarkets, and what else did I do? I wrote to places like the GDR Museum in Berlin and Hohenschönhausen, the Stasi prison, and asked if they had any sort of people who prepared to act as eyewitnesses. And then from there, I suppose those people had other East German friends, and it sort of snowballed from there.
Is there still a snootiness about oral history? I mean, that's an established historiographical approach, certainly.
Yeah, I think that there most definitely is. I think historians generally are much more comfortable with the written source that doesn't answer back.
You work at the National Archives, so you're familiar with the richness of written sources that exist when you're interrogating the past.
Absolutely, but I think it's really key to, well, use as many sources as possible and to cross-reference and corroborate, and then that really helps to, I guess, make sure that what you're saying is true, you know, is, well, true, that's a difficult concept for a historian, but as accurate as possible. But I guess with a lot of social history, be it looking at thousands of letters and diaries or talking to people firsthand, there's always the question of how representative are your findings. But in both cases, whether I was looking at letters between husbands and wives and parents and children or talking to people face to face, I found that whatever the questions that I was particularly preoccupied with in my work, common threads emerged very quickly from the people's stories that I learned about.
Our reviewer of this book said she thought it was a particularly brave approach, given certain reluctance in some of the discipline to draw on things like case studies, and here you focus on 8 people, that it would be much easier to perhaps, or more acceptable to cover this subject, the idea of how people were changed by their life in East Germany and how they view it now, by doing something perhaps more neutral or perhaps less veering toward what some people would say is scholarly journalism. You know, obviously a journalistic approach, you could imagine an article on this saying, we've found these 3 or 4 people and talked to them about their experiences, a first-person account, you know, a particularly well-written magazine article. Is that part of the problem in the same way that ethnographers are often accused of being really just journalists who are hanging around?
Well, maybe more traditional historians might think it's, you know, too easy to just speak to people. But I think mostly their concerns are kind of the reliability of of what you find, and also the fact that doing interviews is incredibly time consuming. You both have to spend time finding the people, then listening to their stories, and then I suppose listening to it and transcribing it, you know, a two-hour interview, especially for me, in which interviews in German would, you know, take me near almost a day, I suppose, to transcribe. And that's before you've even thought about what the interviews might mean. And obviously I didn't feature all the people in great depth in the story, so that's quite a lot of legwork before you've started thinking. So and if you think that the results are not very reliable, you'd think you'd be much better to stick to letters. But I suppose, you know, right from when I was a little girl, I was interested in the stories about people, what made me interested in history. So for me, nothing better could be nothing better than sitting opposite someone and talking to them. And it wasn't really a case of simply writing up their stories, but also, you know, reading everything that had already been written in the field by other experts, and then, I suppose, contextualising those stories. And my intended audience, as much as academics, was also, you know, ordinary people who were interested in the subject, something, a good, easy way in for students to the subject through, you know, vivid stories.
And it's not just first-person narratives. Obviously, as you say, it's informed by that other reading. I like the fact that you made a defense of the value of people's memories, because we all know that memories can be unreliable. Your previous work looking at the Nazi era, I guess a lot of us are think about the issues of interviewing people or people's defense of what they did, you know, in the Nazi era in Germany. And presumably that was an issue, too, with the eight people you were talking to here, because people from the former East Germany, I guess, are asked by people in West Germany or other places about whether they were against the regime or not.
Yeah, and I think the way people remember things is in itself telling. So, and that's why I chose eight very different stories, so I could look at how one event was experienced universally, but then felt very differently in each life.
I recall you saying here that the way people recall life in the GDR is just so different that it's surprising to find that they lived in the same country.
Well, I think as a starting point for the research, I was struck at how, certainly in sort of popular consciousness, there are two particularly prominent memories of the GDR, mm-hmm. or kind of versions of the GDR. One is a kind of Stasi-stented memory, so focused on the East German secret police and how they had 91,000 full-time employees in the 1980s. And they collected more paper files in 40 years, from 1949 till 1989, than had been collected in Germany from the medieval period until the end of the Second World War. So they collected a staggering amount of information about East German citizens, and they tapped people's phones, wired people's houses, and even collected smell samples in jars so that, at least in theory, sniffer dogs could track where political suspects had been. So on the one hand, you have this very dark portrayal of how of life in a Stasi state in which ordinary people, so the logic would go, were feeling totally vulnerable and afraid and fearful of being imprisoned the entire time. So a very kind of a kind of police state. And then on the other hand, you have a much rosier memory of life in the GDR, which is perhaps coloured by the fact that there's been rampant unemployment in East Germany since the fall of the wall, the fact that in East Germany there was, in communist East Germany, there was near full employment, and maybe there was a sense of solidarity. People often mentioned that in their interviews, that sense of togetherness that they no longer felt. And so there's a sort of, also, as alongside this dark Stasi image of the GDR, there's this sort of nostalgic picture of simpler times, in which simpler and friendlier times, I suppose.
You mention also Peter Schneider's famous line, die Mauer im Kopf, the wall in the head, and it seems that all of the eight people you interview, the past is not past, for good or for ill.
And maybe it would be surprising if the past could be shrugged off so easily, but the GDR was in power the communists were in power in East Germany for 40 years, and all the people in the book had, as you said at the start, were born in 1961 or afterwards, so they had known nothing other than living in a walled-in communist system. It was obviously a huge change. You know, they could, when the wall fell, yes, they spoke the same language as West Germans and they had the same sort of long-term history, but really, there's a whole kind of outlook and way of life that was very different. And so they, both East and Westerners, found each other quite foreign when it came to sort of reuniting. And there was solidarity between East and West when the division was in place, but kind of once the wall fell, the differences became much more pronounced. So,
Mentioned, I thought it was very interesting that you mentioned that friendships between people on either side of the wall, while the wall was up, often in a sort of supportive, sending packages to people behind the wall.
Millions of packages.
Did not only from family members, but as a sort of charitable endeavour, didn't persist often after unification. Or perhaps you suggest that maybe it was the position in which the West Germans
saw themselves as benefactors. The sort of do-gooders doing the right thing by friends or relatives in the GDR. I think it's maybe when there was unparalleled access to one another, there was just a realization that, you know, they were really quite different, or it certainly took a long time for especially for East Germans, the socialization under socialism to, that wasn't something they could just shrug off like a coat. A lot of them talked about just how profoundly difficult it was. You know, they were so grateful for the freedom of travel, the freedom of expression that they hadn't had under the Stasi, the fact that they could choose their own career in the way that in a command economy there was much less choice about what job you did. It seems staggering to us now in the West, I think. But they also said that they were very conscious of how they were different from West Germans, that they dressed differently, maybe they used different words, they spoke differently, and they behaved differently. The cliche is that the West Germans were just a lot more confident and, you know, to the point of arrogance.
Bossy, patronising.
Yeah.
Everything's better in the West.
Yeah, and I think after a while, although the East Germans were very pleased to be able to go to the supermarket and have a wide range of goods that hadn't been available before, they also, started to take offence that it seemed like nothing from their old lives was worth saving. You know, in East Germany, 97% of women had worked, and so they were far more integrated into the workplace than they were in West Germany, and maybe that was because that was a culture that the state had, encouraged or made almost mandatory. But nonetheless, that had shifted attitudes amongst East German women about what their role was, even if they initially wanted, many of them may have actually preferred to have been at home. But the fact that they had all, the majority of women had worked, meant that the people who I spoke to, some of the women that I spoke to, who were of the next generation, as they came of age, their expectation was that they too would go out to work. And then they found in West Germany that it was a lot more difficult because childcare was a lot more expensive, as opposed to being free and covering many hours, as opposed to in West Germany. So there was a sense that an irritation that nothing from their old lives was worth saving, wherein they felt that actually the West could learn from the East.
You mentioned psychologist Walter Friedrich, who talked about the chaos after unification and the sense amongst East Germans that there was a kind of black hole in their biographies, that the sense that things were being rejected. Let's talk a little bit about the eight people you spoke to. You mentioned that you spoke to some 30 people in depth and then chose eight who were representative in different ways. And maybe we could talk, I suppose, one of the most compelling figures and one of the saddest stories here is of Mario, who was gay, who was imprisoned in Hohenschönhausen, who was allowed to go to the West in the end, but has suffered greatly in terms of mental health as a result of what's happened to him and doesn't work. And
yeah, I mean, Mario was a waiter. When he left school, he became a waiter, and he started in Schönefeld Airport, and where there was a lot of traffic between East and West, and he met a West German politician and started a relationship with him. And this was something that before I'd started my research, I thought it was very curious that you'd be able to sustain a relationship across the wall, but it was much easier for West Germans to go into East Germany than the other way around. So they were able to... Gottfried is the name that Mario's given to this boyfriend, and he used to come over and they'd to East Berlin, and they'd go clubbing and do whatever couples then did. And but then Mario was approached by the Stasi and asked if he would pass on information about Gottfried, because I think the idea was that if the East German government knew about what was going on in the politics in the West, maybe that they'd have more leverage or influence. You know, knowledge is power was definitely something that the Stasi sort of mentality was bound up with. But Mario refused, and then he was demoted from his job, and the Stasi followed him round, and he just found it incredibly stifling, and he really just wanted out, and he wanted, crucially, to be with Gottfried. So he planned to escape, but unfortunately he planned to escape through Yugoslavia, but unfortunately he was caught in his attempt and then taken to Hohenschönhausen prison, where he was incarcerated for 3 months, and basically this 3 months in prison, even though he wasn't physically beaten, the kind of mental torture of the interrogation room has had profound and long-term effects on him, to the point that he isn't able to sustain a full-time job. He gives tours of the prison. All of the guides at Hohenschönhausen are former inmates. But initially he did that sort of several times a week, but he found that... his identity was becoming too bound up with the prison, and he needed more distance from that. And luckily, because of the psychological damage caused by, the psychological damage caused by his experiences meant that he now receives a pension from the state, so he's not under enormous sort of stress to put bread on the table in the way that many other East Germans who have struggled to find work are, or certainly were, in the initial 10 years after the fall of the wall.
And Mario's quite angry, isn't he, that so few, I think only three Stasi members have been prosecuted since then. There is a, when you go to Hohenschönhausen and you see the pictures of the people who work there, and you see that none of them have subsequently been in prison themselves. Many of them still live in the area. You can hear the Saxon accent, and some of them even tail the former inmates who give talks there. In fact, I've been told being there, they come on the tours in order to
heckle
and film them secretly. So, his anger seems quite understandable.
Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose from the point of view of the German government, as they were trying to forge reunification, which was full of all sorts of problems, seeing as East and West Germany both had their own flags, their own armed forces, their own legal and educational system, their own health system, all of these things had to be reconciled. And since 91,000 people work for the Stasi full time, if the aim was to put that behind Germany and to forge a united path, I think a decision was sort of taken to focus on the future rather than the past. But you can see that from the point of view of anyone who has faced persecution in East Germany, this is deeply unsatisfactory. And that's why Mario goes to schools and gives talks to children about what it was really like to live under communism from his perspective, because I think he feels like there's been a sort of the rosy image of the GDR is too prevalent, and he wants to make sure that, you know, the things that he experienced also get some airtime too.
Let's talk about your fellow historian, Robert, who's another of the people that you interview for this book. He was a supporter of the idea of socialism at the time. He was a party loyalist. And although you say that, you know, no one you interviewed of the eight people wants the GDR to come back, he seems to be furthest along the scale of thinking that, you know, they got to go to punk concerts. It was great. Things were had a lot to be said for them, and people in the West don't understand that. And he seems like the most ardent defender of the SED, or at least of East Germany, of the people you interviewed.
I mean, I don't think he thinks the way socialism was put into practice under the SED was by any means perfect. But in contrast to Mario, his childhood growing up in the GDR was not plagued with difficulties as a result of the state. And of course, that affects his perspective. He grew up in a household that was strongly kind of advocating socialist values. And, you know, it didn't do him any harm. And he said actually that, you know, his family did much better in the socialist system than they would have done under a capitalist one. You know, they had status. And so I think also the way he talks about the GDR is also a reaction to the way that West Germans have kind of denigrated East Germany and belittled it and suggested that there was nothing good that could be brought into reunited Germany.
You mentioned in the book that the GDR is now evaluated almost exclusively through a Western lens. Is there a sense that there are more opportunities now for Eastern voices to be heard on their own terms? Obviously, you're writing for an English language audience, but in terms of the works that are being published in Germany now, obviously, in the context of fiction, Maxim Leo's book Red Love, is there more of a sense that we're hearing from East Germans themselves about their background?
Yeah, I think gradually we are hearing more from East Germans. In Berlin, for example, they've in the past maybe 3 or 4 years founded this third generation East sort of group. It's a kind of a group for those who were born, who were sort of still children when the GDR fell. But they meet and talk about how how the tail end of their childhood under communism sort of has affected their lives and also their families, because in many cases, parents were unemployed. And so although, as I said, there were many benefits to the change, there were also, I think those benefits really paled if you had been able to sort of eat and not have any money worries before, and then suddenly afterwards unemployed for a long time, and then that would loom larger in your feelings about the change.
And you mentioned that the unemployment levels in East Germany, although Helmut Kohl promised that standard of living would match that of the West in 5 years, that hasn't really happened, and unemployment is particularly pronounced amongst East German women.
Yep.
So that 97% employment is clearly not the case now.
And interestingly, even now, the rate of unemployment in the former East Germany is almost double what it is in the West. So although I guess a lot of the East Germans I spoke to felt like the problems following reunification, that the government liked to see those problems as being self-correcting, that they could sort of just ignore and things would get better. You know, that's a significant statistic to show that that the consequences of communism live on in a kind of tangible sense.
You mentioned that most recent statistics say that 31% of former East Germans do not think the GDR was a dictatorship. Are they deluded?
It's very difficult to say, but no, I don't think they were, because if you were Robert and, you know, barely had a brush with the Stasi had a very happy and, I guess, you know, with nothing else to compare it to, what felt like a normal life, if you had no encounters with the Stasi, why would you see it as a Stasi state? If you believed in socialism, maybe you know, people would have maybe not felt that they had anything to fear. Of course, talk to different people and you'll get a different answer, and that's precisely what I wanted to do and what I did.
It must be hard not to take criticism. It's a little bit like if you can complain about your brother for being lazy and untidy, but if someone else criticizes him, the hackles go up. And I suppose it's hard not to see criticism of the East German system, or reducing it to, oh, you were living in a prison camp, as an attack on who you are, even though people are talking about a political system. You mentioned the quote, even in a topsy-turvy world, even a topsy-turvy world is home when everyone lives there.
Yeah, and I think the last chapter of my book on a girl who was 10 when the world fell, Peggy, she talked about when she goes home to where her parents live, none of her relatives are doing the same jobs as they were doing before the wall fell, where there was the equivalent of Sainsbury's in the GDR, Konsum was one of them, and Ha, or the Handelsorganisation, and those were two East German supermarkets. They're not there anymore. So everything's changed, and what everyone's doing has changed. And obviously, she says, she knows that for West Germans too, they might be nostalgic that things have changed in their area, but in their hometowns, but they just obviously haven't changed as fundamentally.
Who would you like to have spoken to that you didn't manage to find one of? An ex-Stasi informer or guard? Is there anyone that on your mental wish list you really wish you'd found a sample of?
Not really. I mean, it might have been interesting to talk to an ex-Stasi officer, but Anna Funder has done that very comprehensively in her I think brilliant book Stasi Land, and I was deliberately trying to get away from a focus on the Stasi, because that's not really how the majority of East Germans remember the GDR. From the outside, obviously, those sensational details are very captivating, and it's very interesting to hear from Mario about what it was like in solitary confinement and what the experience was like in the interrogation room with a good cop and a bad cop. But the whole purpose of my book really was trying to give a variety of perspectives, and I felt that perspective was already quite covered.
25 years is kind of a short period of time, I suppose, and as a historian you'd be more conscious of that than most. Should we be surprised that so many changes persist in terms of people's thinking? I mean, if people look at the United States and they talk about the North and South, they talk about, you know, the lingering effects of the Civil War and slavery, and they were a lot longer ago than 25 years. So should we be waiting a lot longer to see these sort of economic inequalities and ways of thinking, seeing them merging, perhaps?
That's an interesting question. I mean, as a historian, you're always going to be interested in continuity and change. And in my work, I always seem to be drawn to continuity, rather sort of making the case for continuity. But I think it doesn't hurt 25 years on to see how things have evolved, and how people are talking about the GDR and remembering it. And maybe that's a good benchmark to compare with in another 25 years, how much things have changed. But I think 40 years of communism in a divided country will take decades to really put behind Germany, really.
Each person's story is different, of the people you speak to in the book and the wider group you interviewed. But you do mention at one point that, of course, everyone goes through in your teenage years a questioning and rebellious phase, or at least that's a possibility for teenagers. Did you see any difference in the people who were the youngest when the wall came down? Of course, it's possible to be politically conscious at the age of 10, and you may be 18 and never have been rebellious. But do you think that it was more likely that people who had already been, say, 15, 16, 17, and maybe struggling against parental authority or school, would have seen things slightly differently than the ones who were still 7, 8, 9, feeling happier?
Yeah, I think for most of the people featured in the book, their struggles with the state really intensified. Well, for those who did struggle in their later teenage years, I'd say growing up in the GDR, I think the people I spoke to were a lot more politically conscious than I think maybe and active than young people are today. But that's because most of them were in the Young Pioneers, the East German equivalent to the Hitler Youth, in which they were meant to be inculcated with socialist principles, I guess that was the whole point. So it's not really surprising that they were politicised. But yes, I think it was sort of as I think. Obviously, all you know, most teenagers might go through a stage of challenging their parents, but this was a lot more serious because if teenagers challenged the state, they could get into a lot of trouble, and that could affect whether they were able to do A levels or go to university, and really affect their future prospects. So it wasn't just a matter of being
surly.
Yeah, being surly.
Mirko, one of the people you interviewed for the book, said that his experience of those kinds of politically charged youth activities and the effect it had on people made him understand why the Hitler Youth had succeeded and had been such a force. Now, that seems like a useful point, but I suppose sometimes that comparison is overstated. The idea of talking about East Germany as being the second German dictatorship, the idea of, I mean, to what extent, you know, you've studied the Nazi era in Germany as well. Do you see eerie parallels between the two, or are you more in agreement with Robert, who is a historian and says one should not compare Nazi Germany and the GDR because they're completely different things?
Well, I think they are different. And I guess with any comparison, are you comparing apples and pears, or is it square pegs and round holes? One of the people who isn't actually featured in this book, I talked to her about, she hadn't done her A-levels in East Germany, but went back to night school and did her A-levels in reunited Germany. And she was one of two East Germans in a class of West Germans. And she said they learnt about Nazism for their A-levels. And she said this other East German girl and her just looked at each other, and there's a sort of moment of realisation that so many aspects of life in a dictatorship in Nazi Germany were similar to what they had been through, obviously pretty unconsciously. So I think there are definitely parallels, but I think they're more different than they are similar.
And so to that extent, Robert's points do have validity when he talks about the number of people who were killed by the Nazis versus 132 going over the wall.
It is. I suppose is there a danger of trying to kind of reject a comparison because
the scale is different.
Potentially one could see his point as being, you know, very defensive of the GDR despite its, you know, problems. But I think, you know, there's definitely something valid in that argument.
So you're a German-speaking British historian. How were you seen by interviewees and prospective interviewers? I guess the feeling that amongst East Germans or former East Germans that a lot of their story has been told through a Western filter, I could see how it would make people maybe hesitant to speak to a German interviewer or historian from the West. Did you seem like more of a neutral party?
I think I did. I think people were freer. I think I'd have got different and probably shorter answers if I'd been West German. I mean, the whole process of meeting total strangers and them divulging, you know, quite intimate details about their lives was utterly fascinating, from the, you know, arriving in Dresden train station, walking in the wrong direction, fearing being late for the interview, and then hopping into the car of a strange man who offered me a lift, and then that turned out fine. But then I was wandering up the stairs to meet Mirko, and you know, you just don't know what you're going to find at the top of the stairs. Someone's agreed to meet you, but whether and then a man with waist length hair and with a hairband answered the door, you know, hair that I'd never seen on a man before. And you know, and we had a really fascinating chat. He was obviously very interested in aircraft, and I found we were sitting in seats that had once been on aeroplanes. I mean, there are just such different scenarios. In one interview, I had to take my shoes off and was given a pair of slippers, and I nearly walked out the door wearing the grandfather's slippers. I mean, there were all sorts. I mean, it's a fascinating process, aside from, you know, obviously what I found.
Did you feel that people trusted you to represent their viewpoints? Because obviously some of them would not agree with each other if they were discussing their background.
Well, that varied, and it was more of a problem than I anticipated, perhaps naively. I asked supplementary questions via email and did second and third interviews with some of the people that I featured in the book. I also sent them draft versions of the chapter and asked for their input. But obviously, as a historian, it's quite difficult. You want to represent the story as you see it, but obviously there's an issue of permissions, especially mm-hmm. when people are alive. Some of the accounts are anonymised for that reason, but they all saw a version of their chapter and were pleased with it. There was one I was going to originally have nine lives, and one person got cold feet and decided that even if it was anonymised, they just didn't want that personal information about them out there, and despite my best persuasion, that there's nothing I could do about that. So I think, you know, oral history, you know, living people are fascinating in one sense, but obviously from a historian's perspective, if I'd written, you know, that was a month's worth of work, you know, 7,000 words, it's not ideal, but obviously entirely the right of the person if they didn't want to be in the story.
And of course, those issues of privacy are ones that are particularly resonant for people where there were those endless miles and miles of files kept on them. And I think you mentioned that Mario in particular feels anxious when he's, you know, having to speak to a bank manager, or and is very concerned, and rightly so, about the amount of personal information that's held on him, even in the United Germany. So I'm sure that issue of how their words would be used must have really concerned a lot of
I think it's totally understandable. You've trusted us effectively a stranger with your life story, and it's going to be in print. Obviously, from a publisher's perspective, they were also keen to lock in some pretty carefully worded permissions, so that there was no possibility of being sued afterwards. But you know, I built up good rapport with the people. I mean, that in itself could be viewed as a problem by historians. So I guess in an ideal world, you'd be being neutral. But, you know, all historians have baggage. But I think, you know, everyone was in the end happy with the way they were represented. And I think the fact that they were able to clarify and make additional suggestions actually really enriched the story in a way that dealing with letters is just, it wouldn't be possible.
Were they interested to know what your political leanings were, what your view of things were? Do you think they Googled you to find out what else you'd written about?
I think I told them, I told them sort of who I was and what I'd done in the past, and that I'd, you know, written my first book about family life in the Second World War in Germany. But I don't think they were really that interested in my political leanings. I think they thought it was refreshing to talk to someone who was outside of it. And, you know, initially, you know, having with my first book really focused on, you know, the 1930s and 40s, this was a big jump to suddenly go to 1989, and I suppose the 40 years sort of after the war, as well as obviously reading lots of books and for background information. Now, I was learning all the time, so I think they were pleased that I was interested and glad to be able to offer their views on, give their perspective, because I think there was a sense that the likes of the Spiegel magazine would be very, as told to me by them, I don't know how true it is, that the media in reunited Germany is quite dominated by a Western perspective, despite obviously having Angela Merkel as the former East German as the Chancellor. So they were pleased to be able to, you know, share their experiences.
And this obviously is your second book. Does it get easier? Your first book grew out of your doctoral thesis. This is an entirely new piece.
Well, I think with your after your PhD, when you're getting published for the first time, you know, this is really hopefully the book that's going to get you a job. And so you're kind of having to test your, to kind of show your prowess and your research skills. And maybe, you know, my PhD supervisor had said, don't touch oral history with a barge pole. It's a lot of effort. And, you know, the results are really iffy. But by the time I'd already got a job, had my first book published.
And won a prize for it and were nominated for another.
Very kind of you to mention that, Karen. Yeah, the Frankel Prize for Contemporary History. Let's not forget that. After I'd done that, well, I just thought, well, I want to write the book I want to write, and that involves talking to people, and that wasn't, you know, problem-free. And obviously it's for the readers to judge whether that's... whether the results are worth all that effort.
And now you're bringing it out to the general public via a series of readings as well.
Yes.
Who do you think will be there?
I think
you're doing a number of them. It can't be family for all of them.
Well, I've got a very big family,
well,
so that is helpful. I'm hoping they're going to buy a lion's share of the copies. But, I hope the audience is going to be healthy, and I think people who are interested in Germany, maybe they've done a German degree or lived in Germany, or, you know, people who've lived through the fall of the Berlin Wall, that's a lot of people, and they'll remember where they were when the wall fell. I was actually celebrating my 8th birthday the day the wall fell, but I think just people who are interested in the Cold War.
I have to say I was particularly delighted that even of these people whose lives were so affected by the fall of the wall and what came after, that at least some of them were sleeping through it. Because when I think about the fall of the wall, I can't actually remember what I was doing. I think I might have been waitressing, but it took a while for it to sink in.
Well, my favourite of the 8 stories in the book is 10-year-old Peggy. She was used to her mother coming into her room every morning to wake her up. She slept through the fall of the wall, and then on the 10th of November, her mother didn't come into her bedroom. So she got out of bed and went into the kitchen. She could smell bread rolls cooking in the oven and hear the splatter of the coffee machine. And she found her mother sitting at the table, nursing a cup of coffee and staring into the middle distance. And her mother she said to her mother, well, why haven't you woken me? And her mother said, the wall's fallen. And she looked, she followed her mother's gaze out into the garden and saw the wall there, which was still standing perfectly fine. And so Peggy was quite confused. And her mother said, no, not that wall, the wall in Berlin. And so that was the moment that she found out. Others, of course, had been dancing atop the Berlin Wall, drinking champagne and embracing strangers. And I suppose that's what we most commonly associate with the night of the 9th of November. But for a lot of people who lived through that moment, East Germans, they were fearful about what might happen next. You know, they'd, in propaganda from the East, they'd learnt that the West was full of unemployment,
and drugs.
Drugs and homelessness and prostitution. And so they didn't, although they had seen on television the kind of more positive, sort of glamorous sort of aspects of life as shown through adverts, actually there was some trepidation, not least because when there'd been protests against communism elsewhere, there'd been real bloodshed in Hungary in 56 and in Prague in 68. So there was a concern that there would be bloodshed in East Germany too. So it was with great relief that didn't come to pass.
Hester, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Karen.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.